back. It's the World Soccer Talk podcast, the only podcast that focuses on watching soccer on TV, online, and apps. In episode 95, we discuss our thoughts on TNT's latest coverage of the Champions League, MLS TV ratings take another nosedive, why soccer fans could be dealt a big blow if Univision supporters leaves Dish, Netflix reveals which sports network could be a leader in the future, and we have a bunch of letters from you, the listeners, in our mailbag section. My name is Christopher Harris, a.k.a. The Gaffer, and I'm joined by my co-host, Kartik Krishnire. Kartik, a lot to talk about what we've been watching this past week. Was there one match that stood out for you as a classic, kind of a memorable game?
One match that stood out. That's a very good good question, and we're doing this every week. I mean, I would have to say that for me, probably the best match of the week was the Eintracht-Fortuna Dusseldorf match, just the most entertaining match just because Eintracht scored so many goals and looked rampant. But probably the best match was Chelsea-Man United, which was the first – and leave it to Mourinho. This was the first really high-level match I saw in the Premier League this season. I know everybody raves about how great the Premier League is and it's the best league in the world. I quite frankly don't see that in terms of quality. I see a lot of bad giveaways in midfield. I see a lot of defensive errors, tactical, you know, shape being frayed, stuff that I don't see as regularly in other top European leagues. But this match was really good, really a nice tactical battle. Jose opted to play with a more attacking-oriented side. He put Juan Mata in the lineup, whether that was a forced change due to injuries and, quite frankly, discussed with Alexis Sanchez, which is understandable, or whether that was a one-off for this match. We really don't know, although he started Sanchez, obviously, against Juventus too, so maybe it wasn't a one-off. And importantly, from the broadcast perspective, I think Derek Ray brings something to these big Premier League matches for me that Arlo White doesn't. Now, I know it depends on what your personal preferences are, what your cup of tea is, so to speak, in terms of presentation and match commentators. But I think I just enjoy Derek Ray's scene setting and the way he's able to kind of guide you through a match like this.
Yeah, and this one, I mean, it was another crazy weekend for me with my kids, soccer tournaments, and just all over South Florida. So I missed a lot of the Chelsea Man United match. I did get back for towards the end of the second half, and of course, I mean, this was the thing that I think you tweeted about, Kartik, to say that, I mean, it's a great match, but then it's all going to be overshadowed by what happens with Mourinho at the end of the game. But I did think that both Derek Ray and Phil Neville did a really good job of calling it as it was happening and talking about, I think Derek Ray said, all eyes, as usual, on Jose Mourinho. And just talking about the incident, and Phil Neville coming out straight away and saying this is despicable behavior. Of course, he's a ex-Man United fan, so you would think that he'd be kind of more pro-United and anti-Chelsea. But as the replays showed, Man United was, you mean, it was definitely a bad behavior from the coach on Chelsea. So I think Phil Neville in this instance was correct. But yeah, it was entertaining. And that's the thing, though, too, Kartik, is that the soap opera often overshadows the actual game itself. I have to wonder, after this happened, Kartik, I was thinking to myself, how much of this is like Mourinho knowing exactly that the TV cameras are on him and just creating a spectacle just to have that to be the talking point rather than the talking point being that United gave away a couple of points and ended up with a draw? You mean, I have to wonder how much, not that this would be premeditated, but he seems to be very much always in the action and trying to take the storyline away from his team's performance.
Yeah, I think that's Jose's psychology. He's a master of deflection. He's a master of mind games. And perhaps there is a desire now to plow on with him from the Man United board, from the players. So he's deflecting, taking some blame away from the players, and he's putting it on himself, which is a management tactic that other managers employ. Now, as far as the incident at the end of the match, that was classic Jose. I mean, in fact, and maybe it's me personally as a Manchester City supporter, I have an issue with Mourinho being seen as a victim because he did this in a very blatant fashion to Manuel Pellegrini at the same ground exactly 5 years ago when there was a mix-up at the back in stoppage time, and Nastasic and Joe Hart essentially ran into each other and allowed Fernando Torres to tap in a match winner that Mourinho decided to go and celebrate in front of Pellegrini and then run to the stands behind the Manchester City bench, which it's really kind of inappropriate theatric behavior. Not from, we're talking about an assistant manager with Chelsea. He was the manager of Chelsea at the time. And he also did this humiliating slide in front of Roberto Mancini in 2012 in a Champions League match in Madrid when Madrid got a late winner against Manchester City, 3-2 match that was. So I don't have a whole lot of sympathy for him. I think this is a culture he's helped create and foster in world football and in English football. But in terms of this specifically, I think maybe it was a shrewd piece of management in terms of taking the pressure off his players, who had just blown 2 points.
Well, one more thing to add to this, though, too, Kartik, is whether it's three fingers he's holding up or four fingers he's holding up, and whether it's at Stamford Bridge or Old Trafford, this to me feels like it's almost like a victory tour. Like he's kind of like doing kind of his last tour as kind of an aging rock and roll star, and just reminding all the fans from his team and other teams about all of the achievements and all of the medals he's won, and it seems like kind of it's kind of a kind of a farewell tour in many ways, just to remind people how great he was. You mean whether that's intentional or not? Probably not. But well, it's intentional that he's doing it. But I don't think that's what he's trying to prove. But he's just really dwelling on the past. And I'm sure there's a lot of Man United fans too that would like to see him move on and bring somebody fresh and new into this team that's going to play a more attractive style of play. For me, Kartik, my match of the week was Arsenal against Leicester. Just an absolutely sublime performance by Mesut Ozil, involved in all three of Arsenal's goals. Just a really sensational display of football by Arsenal. Also have to mention some great pre-match analysis about how this Arsenal team has changed for the benefit. And that was courtesy of Carlo Martino and Robbie Musto. Some good analysis there. Some things that you could sink your teeth into and definitely think about some good points that they raised. Now, Kartik, we have to talk about Turner Sports and TNT and their coverage of the Champions League. For the last two match weeks, I think we've been fair, but we've been critical. There's definitely been lots of mistakes. There's been lots of awkward silences, just a really bad flow, and just it seemed to be all over the place. What were your thoughts about their coverage this week for Tuesday's and Wednesday's Champions League games?
Okay, given how low the bar was from the first two match days, and then obviously the Super Cup and the play-in rounds, I was in the way. I don't know why it took them almost half the group stage to get this figured out. I don't know if it was the commentary on this podcast, on the World Soccer Talk website, on social media, particularly Twitter and Reddit, about their presentation, but I found it far improved in many aspects. We can go through those one by one in a minute, but I found it far improved. I found it far more relatable. I found it far more useful in terms of a match analysis and actually talking about matches. And I thought, again, I think Carlos Bocanegra, he's getting better. He's not quite there. I think Moadu was pretty good. And then I think the rest of the group, Kate Abdo was the best I've seen her on Turner. Tim Howard was very, very good. Now, again, this piece of analysis holds from previous weeks. Why he is only there Wednesdays, they need to figure that out because the group is better with him. And then Nash and Holden were very good. And there weren't the clunky transitions. The production was better. I also want to say even the camera work was better this week in the studio. And the dress, while still kind of this hip, urbane look, was a little more reserved. I enjoyed it. I mean, I thought it was actually this week, if we just take these two as a sample size, I think they're now, in terms of their studio programs, probably better than Fox. Again, it's a small sample size, but I think that the trajectory is upwards, and I don't know where this came from, Chris. I mean, the last thing I'll say about this is my concern is, was this due to a lack of poor planning and late hires based on from Turner, hiring people late, not getting them familiar with each other, not having enough adequate dry runs so that in August and September and early October they weren't as poor as they were? Or is it them changing their philosophy already? Either way, I guess we'll take it. It's an improvement. I just don't know why they were so poor out of the gates. And then we've seen, I think, a pretty radical improvement. Again, about 2 months in.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely thought the coverage was much tighter, both the pregame, halftime, and post-match. Lots of improvements made. I would say I still think that the analysis is lacking. I think you mentioned a couple of some positives there, but for me, the analysis, I'm still not getting anything substantial, anything like a takeaway where I'm like, oh, that was a good thought. I didn't think of that. It's very pedestrian. And I would say that definitely the talent was a lot more comfortable on set. So Tim Howard, Maurice Sadoux, Carlos Bocanegra was better. So the kind of the level of presentation and just the comfort level and the back and forth, that's good. It's just that for me personally speaking, I'm just getting nothing substantial from the analysis. So much so that on Wednesday after the games ended, I thought to myself, should I watch the post game? Is there going to be anything I'm going to learn from this to walk away from that's going to enrich my knowledge of the game? And I said, probably not, based on what I saw on Tuesday. So I kind of just walked away and said, okay, let me just switch the channel and go on to something else. But overall, though, speaking a lot better. A couple of points, Kartik. I think after the Ike buy-in game on Tuesday, with the early game, they immediately went to the developing story from Old Trafford, which was that the Man United bus was stuck in traffic. And I thought that was good because they were obviously watching social media, paying attention to that, and letting the viewer know what's happening at the stadium. So I think that was very important. I also enjoyed the segment with Fernando about Ike Athens and graffiti in Greece. And that was interesting about bringing an Ike Athens legend and having him see a piece of graffiti that Bleacher Report put together. That was good. The other interesting thing, too, I think, Kartik, is that a little bit of a change here is that on Tuesday and Wednesday, they had segments in pre-match. Tuesday's pre-match segment was about Man United. And then I think Wednesday's pre-match segment was about Liverpool, the Ale, Ale, Ale song. And I think that it's interesting that TNT, while trying to also, I mean, obviously talk about PSG and Barca and the impact of Messi being out, they're certainly making more of a play now to fans of the English game than they did in previous game weeks. And maybe it's looking at the TV ratings, maybe thinking to themselves, okay, well, we're not gonna smash Real Madrid out of the park and win the ratings game that way. So is it better to target more of the Anglo audience that are going to be watching, looking for Man United or looking for, Chelsea in the Europa League or whatever it may be, and going after that and trying to build that up and trying to get some of the TV ratings from the NBC crowd rather than from the Univision crowd. But overall, I was really, really impressed by the coverage this week, and I hope it continues. I just hope that the analysis, again, too much agreeing with one another and too little value, really, in terms of what they were saying. It just seemed like something that if I went to the pub and talked to some of my mates, it would be the same level of conversation and nothing enlightening.
Yeah, and one quick criticism I have was that the halftimes, this didn't necessarily happen on Wednesday, but happened on Tuesday. The halftimes on Tuesday, I think they were racing through the highlights so quickly that Bocanegra and Adu, particularly Adu, because he was contributing more in terms of analysis, had points about what we were seeing, and then they'd move on to the next clip or the next match. Because they have packed, as so many people on social media have reminded us, they have packed so many commercials into halftime. So they were not able to really give Mo Adu in this occasion the opportunity to analyze what he was watching, what they were showing us on television. So that's something I know they paid. We have to remind our listeners how much they paid for the rights, how much more they paid for the rights than Fox had ever paid for these rights. So we realize they have to monetize it and earn some of that money back to the Time Warner, to the Turner family. But that was unfortunate because I think Adu was making some pretty good points, actually, about what we were seeing. But he would be making a point about one match and we'd be watching the clip from the next match. Because they were so quickly. I mean, I want to say they did maybe 3 minutes of studio time and 9 minutes of commercials. That may sound ridiculous, but that's what it felt like, at least.
Yeah, it does. And also, even I think Kate Abdo, she was going through the halftime results of the games on Tuesday, and didn't even get to the end, and they already moved on to kind of the next part of the that segment. So she was kind of caught aback too, as far as how fast that was moving. And I think that'll just take a little bit of time just to get adjusted to that speed of how quickly they have to go through things. But overall, I thought I walked away both on Tuesday and Wednesday with a feeling that I had a better appreciation for the results of the games, and that I knew what was going on and what the main talking points were, and that's something that I didn't have in previous games.
And the piece of analysis that Tim Howard gave about Cavani not getting the ball from Mbappe and Neymar is the type of analysis I normally have to turn to ESPN FC for.
I
was happy with that.
Yeah, I like that. But then Steve Nash raised a good point though too, and he said, like, I need to see the stats. I need to see the metrics side by side. How does that compare to, let's say, Kane and Eriksen or some other teams? And I think it was interesting that he mentioned that, Tim Howard, and I think a lot of viewers will probably take a closer look at some of those games now when they are playing PSG. But to have those stats available would have been great too, to kind of just drive that point home.
There are a couple times now in the three match days that Steve Nash has raised points that are points that you and I would raise, but that clearly he hasn't been briefed about what they're doing on Bleacher Report online or with the power ratings or in terms of their analysis on the show, because he's asked for things that you and I and other fans would ask for but are not readily available on the set. So maybe they need to brief him a little better on that, but I like the fact that he raises that. That creates a little bit of tension, a little bit of debate, which is good. But I think in both cases, he's probably made the producers or the network not look as great as they could, because he's asking for things that they're not able to provide readily.
Right. Or his comment from a couple of weeks ago about clickbait, which is a fair point, but it's not a good look. I would say that Bleacher Report Live, I didn't watch all of the games on Bleacher Report Live, but I did watch some, and everything seemed to be okay. I didn't have any issues. I think it was only one report that I got through the website of somebody having issues with the Liverpool game. But when I tuned in to watch it, I had no problems watching that Liverpool Red Star Belgrade game. So that's positive too. That's a big if things are as good as we think they are in terms of this week, that's a big plus also. Just making sure that platform is stable and operating as it should. So that's a positive there. Kartik, anything else, Champions League or any other games that stood out for you this past week?
Yeah, I mean, Real Madrid Levante did because of the result, and I thought that was quite good. I think that there had been some pretty good coverage on BN again this weekend of La Liga, although it's very tough when Ray Hudson is doing Barcelona matches. I mean, he just is fairly biased. It feels like. Really like Mark Donaldson's call on the Frosinone-Empoli match. Maybe I'm the only person in the country who watched this match. I DVR all the Serie A matches that are on ESPN2. So I watched this and then realized on my program guide on the top of my DVR, it said this match started at 6:15 or something.
Yeah, that's right.
time. I think I'm the only one who watched it, but Donaldson's had a good call.
Well, actually, the TV rating for that one, let me give it to you now rather than wait to the TV rating section. That one actually had an impressive number. 112,000 viewers tuned in for that game. And it kicked off at 6:30 on Sunday morning.
How is that possible? Well, okay.
ESPN2. Yeah, I mean, to me, it's two teams that are by no means and very popular teams in Serie A. It must have been just timing in terms of people. I mean, kind of maybe your crowd that usually watches the Premier League on Saturday mornings, getting up early on Sunday mornings, flipping through, looking for a game to watch.
And there was no Premier League match, importantly.
Exactly,
early Premier League kickoff. So that's interesting, and it's on ESPN2. So this thing is reaping dividends for Serie A. I'm watching I like Serie A as a league, as I think most people who listen to this show probably know, but I'm getting to watch a lot more of it this year. One other quick note, Monterrey-Toluca, which was on FS1, I was not well advertised, but again, I popped up on my DVR. I saw it a day later. I thought Francisco X. Rivera, who at times we criticized for his English calls, was really good because he was comfortable with both teams. He knew both teams. And Kurt Rodolfo, who's had some experience playing and living in Mexico, obviously is Brazilian-American, American-Brazilian, former MLS coach, Bruce Arena acolyte. Actually, first time I ever heard him on the mic. I've interviewed him when he was coach of Kansas City, but I thought was pretty, or coach of DC United, excuse me. I thought he was pretty good. So that was a decent broadcast for me. So a lot of variety in what I watched this week. I watched Premier League, Bundesliga, Serie A, Liga MX, Champions League, a lot of La Liga. It was actually a very good weekend. The thing that seems to be happening, and this is why the Cavani Neymar discussion is so foreign to me, even though I'm a big fan of Cavani. So if this is happening, I would urge him to move on and go back to Napoli or something in January. I have not watched a single Liga match, I think, all season since that really good Monaco Leon match. I can't remember who it was, Monaco, and yeah, early in the season. Yep. It's just that there's always some better soccer on at the same time as Liga is on BN. And again, the league doesn't seem to be in. And I know this is a bad thing because there are so many good players who come out of that league that then contribute in the Premier League, La Liga, and Serie A. Those three leagues, and actually some in the Bundesliga also. But it's just like I cannot motivate myself to watch it, even though when I've watched the league this season and previous seasons, it's been entertaining. So that's the only league I didn't watch this weekend that's readily available on US television.
Yeah, for me, that's probably one of the leagues I watch the least. But when I do see highlights from that league, I'm always impressed by the quality level. Obviously, I mean, France winning the World Cup is just one example. But it has a lot of talent. And that's the thing, though, too, Kartik. This season, probably more than others, the TV ratings are probably higher just because of one person, just because of Neymar, than they have been in previous years. But like you, there's only so much time, and there's so many other games happening at the same time. It's, you have to kind of pick and choose the matches you want to watch. All right, Kartik, let's move on to TV streaming news.
FIFA President Gianni Infantino has submitted plans for a Club World Cup every season that a World Nations League backed by $25 billion over 12 years from Japanese telecom giant SoftBank. It should be noted, UEFA is not on board with this Club World Cup proposal. And in fact, there's a lot of bickering within UEFA as to whether Infantino came from UEFA, whether they even support him for re-election next year because of this. And the European clubs, as you can imagine, are pressuring their FAs, the top European clubs, to prevent this from happening because it's just going to add to the fixture congestion and then create more and more difficulty. But there's a lot of support for this Club World Cup proposal in other confederations.
Right.
Me.
And this would be the revamped Club World Cup that would be renamed, as a World Nations League, and would have a lot of Premier League clubs in there, in theory, as well as some of the other top clubs from around the world. And like you said, Kartik, UEFA is planning on blocking this one. To me, this is actually kind of a shot against across the bow, also against International Champions Cup, just trying to look at some of the big tournaments that are happening throughout the year. And that really, at this stage, whether you love ICC or not, is one of the dominant kind of international tournament that is kind of outside of your UEFA Champions League or Copa Libertadores, kind of outside of that. And here's FIFA trying to go ahead and really kind of launch this tournament that would happen every year. But I don't see this one happening, but we'll have to wait and see on that one. On to some other news. Netflix says the future of television will be mainly news and sports, and that the future of live television is Rupert Murdoch's New Fox. Now, New Fox, for those listeners who may not know, would be the FS1, FS2, and then the Fox News channel, and the small select number of Fox channels that they have that weren't sold to Comcast. So what this does, actually, Kartik, I mean Disney, not Comcast. So Disney acquired a lot of the Fox Channel's properties from 21st Century Fox. So new Fox, though, is really mostly FS1 and FS2 Fox News Channel. Now, Netflix CEO Reed Hastings is positioning their company as the leader in on-demand broadcast, while everything else, including the new Fox, will be the news and sports leaders. And so I think it's interesting kind of the way he's positioning the market. He's looking at Netflix being on demand and then new Fox as being a leader in the news and sports side of things. And to me, that's kind of, I think, the play that Netflix is looking at. So if you're just binge-watching or switching on the TV just to watch movies or TV series or whatever it may be, that is Netflix. That's all that Netflix is about. While a company like New Fox, that is a huge power, that has FS1, FS2, and Fox News Channel, etc., would be more your news and sports destination. To me, that makes the likelihood that Netflix gets into live sports extremely unlikely, given what Netflix's CEO said this week.
I found that kind of interesting, actually, Chris, real quickly, because the assumption had been Netflix would be a player in whatever live sports bidding and offerings happen in the future. But I think maybe it's the economics of this. You're seeing Amazon and Facebook, they're kind of clawing, getting little pieces here and there, but not really making the impact yet for rights. And then DAZN has just come in with so much money as a streaming service that can potentially outbid anyone, it appears at this point, or will outbid anyone because they're trying to accumulate properties and talent, et cetera.
Yeah, and I think it's Netflix can look at their original programming and say, okay, that's a better investment for us than going ahead and spending, over $1 billion for rights to the Premier League or rights to some of these other top leagues from around the world. So, it makes sense, and actually, it's a good play for New Fox being able to differentiate themselves from Netflix. And then, Kartik, one more news item before we head on.
Yeah, so Dish subscribers are at risk of losing Univision Deportes Network, says the broadcaster. I think those of you that have Dish that are listening to the show already have lost every other Univision channel, which means the matches, the Premier League, the matches from various leagues, Bundesliga, et cetera, that have been on Unimas or Galavision or even Big Univision for Liga MX in the Champions League, you have not been seeing. And now it appears like, according to our report with World Soccer Talk, that Univision Deportes will probably be next.
Yeah, and according to Univision, it says that it's that Dish Network is not agreeing to the terms that Univision is offering for Univision Deportes Network, and it looks very likely at this point that Univision Deportes Network will be pulled from Dish, which means that you won't have access to any Univision networks or games. And there's a lot of games too. You look at the Champions League, Europa League, like you said, Kartik, Bundesliga, Liga MX. You go down the list, Mexican national team games. So it's going to be a big blow to Dish subscribers. Now, moving on to TV ratings. This week, we've got some numbers from Major League Soccer. We had the big game on Sunday, which was the Atlanta against Chicago game on ESPN. I think with Atlanta setting a MLS attendance record, a huge crowd, I think 72,000 fans there for a big match. TV-wise, it didn't do so well. 163,000 viewers on ESPN on Sunday during the 3 to 5 p.m. Eastern window. Another game that was on Sunday, and this one did even worse, this was Minnesota against LA Galaxy. I think the last game at the Minnesota Stadium before they move to a new stadium next year. This was on FS1 on Sunday, 136,000 viewers. So prime time, basically, on a Sunday evening, really poor numbers there from FS1 and disappointing numbers also from ESPN there. Kartik, you want to say something?
Yeah, I mean, I guess there is a lot of discussion about these matches going up head-to-head with the NFL. But again, I don't know how many times I have to have this argument with people about the calendar, and people will say, well, if we shift the calendar to what you prefer, and the reason I prefer it is for soccer or football playing considerations, developing players, playing in more reasonable weather. It improves a lot of things, but that's a debate for another day. But they say, well, you'll be forced to put the season up against football. Well, no, actually the business end of the season would be these sort of important games, teams leaving grounds, playoffs, all of that would go up against non-football. And you're seeing with these ratings this week, even when Atlanta's involved, how the NFL impacts it. Now, that having been said, we had a match from a few weeks ago when the Red Bulls hosted Atlanta, and it was two really high-level teams going head-to-head, fighting for the supporters' shield. The Red Bulls won that match, and that got a good number, and it was up right alongside the NFL. So for people who then also say, hey, you can't go up against football, that's why these ratings are low, I would point to that match and say it depends on the match, it depends on the circumstance. The takeaway from this week is pretty poor, particularly the Atlanta match, because that was Atlanta. And that was a really stunningly low number on ESPN. It was Atlanta and it was ESPN. But I want to see how this thing continues to evolve, because there are certain times where I think there are people who prioritize the NFL over Major League Soccer, who are watching Major League Soccer. And it is, again, a problem of the league maybe appealing to the wrong people for their fan base. And people complaining to reporters, you know, like Jonathan Tannenwald, our friend who's been on the show a few times, complaining to reporters, oh, well, I don't want to watch the Union. They're playing at the same time as the Eagles. Well, you're either a soccer fan or you're not, particularly when the Union are having such a good season this season by their admittedly low standards. I can't imagine the final match of the regular season you wouldn't watch. So because they're playing at the same time as an NFL game. But again, that's me. Maybe MLS has to consider who they're appealing to. If they were appealing to core soccer fans, people who get up and watch the Premier League, people who got up and watched Serie A, as you mentioned earlier in the show, you know, really nice number for a match that kicked off at 6:30 in the morning, then I don't think you have this problem.
Yeah, and that's the thing, too, in terms of that loyalty of a soccer fan. So, like, your example of kind of the Union fan wanting to watch, say, an Eagles game versus instead of the Union game. To me, if you had Manchester United against, I don't know, Everton, which actually they play this Sunday, and with the time change in the UK and the time change not happening yet in the US, that game will be shown from 12 to 2 on Sunday. So it's going to come, you know, right up against NFL games. But to me, if a soccer's good enough and you're such a loyal fan, fans will tune into soccer over NFL, even though the NFL is kind of almost like a religion in the United States. But when the product isn't that good and there's a lot of competition, I just still can't believe that Major League Soccer has not made any changes and continues to put the most relevant, most meaningful games of the season up against NFL. It's just crazy. It's ridiculous. Because even this Sunday, Kartik, right? You got all 11 games in Major League Soccer happening at the same time. I think 4:15 or 4 o'clock Eastern time. It's the last day of the regular season. That's going up straight up against the NFL, and you've got the games like what I think there's one game on television, and that's on I think ESPN, maybe ESPN2, I think it is, or is it Fox? I don't know. But all the other games are on ESPN Plus. So timing wise, the calendar does not match up. It's just ridiculous that they're doing this. Having said that, it's still a little bit of an excuse, I think, for a lot of soccer fans to say, NFL's just more important.
Yeah, I mean, at least they can get the time on Sunday. They can't on Saturday because of college football. They can get the time on networks. Yeah, I'm getting quite tired of arguing with these people about this, and I think the likes of Tannenwald and others are probably feeling the same way. That, look, I mean, you're either a soccer fan or you're not. And I think everybody knows what happens, and there are a million people you can talk to about an Eagles game or a Dolphins game or whatever. I think if you're a soccer fan, if you're a fan of your local MLS club, that's a different experience. I mean, maybe Philadelphia doesn't quite have the culture of Atlanta or Seattle. I mean, those are the most obvious examples. I think Cincinnati will have that kind of culture next year. But I don't get it. I think, again, we're in a position where MLS has done some very good things with the way they structure the end of the regular season in terms of simultaneous kickoffs, making these games more available and relevant, and giving this decision day feel, you know, taking a page from some of the leagues in Europe in the way they market the final two weekends of the regular season, even though, of course, that there you're fighting relegation and fighting for Champions League spots. Here, it's the stakes are a little less lesser, you could say. But unfortunately, we keep running up against this every year, that people say, well, it's going up against the NFL, I really don't care. Well, then you really don't care.
Yeah, and looking at that Atlanta game too, you had almost as many people in the stadium watching the Atlanta-Chicago game as you had on watching the game on television nationwide in a country that's over 300 million people. You had, 72,000 people in the stadium, and 130 something nationally watching that game on television. So to me, that tells me something. That says something's wrong with this. And that game was on a Sunday too, on an NFL Sunday. And it means that, to me, it means that the actual match experience is good. It's a great experience going to the game. You mean singing, chanting, cheering for your team. And with Atlanta seeing a very attacking, fluid type of football, nationally, there's very little appeal because, you mean, it's, yes, watching Atlanta's great, but Chicago's really poor. So it's a really uneven match, and there's a lot of other things on at the same time, as well as other soccer games too. So that's the other thing sometimes we forget too, is that it's not just NFL versus Major League Soccer, but oftentimes it's Major League Soccer against La Liga that might be happening at the same time, where Barcelona or Real Madrid or sometimes PSG from Ligue 1 is playing at the same time too. So that's the other thing too. We're splitting even the soccer community in terms of what they're watching. But at the end of the day, to me, put on a good product and market it well.
Years ago, MLS was dumb enough to put a match on either FS1 or ESPN that went on at the same time as El Clasico. So, I mean, this is the problem also. I can't remember the specifics, but they had a nationally televised game running at the very same time as Barcelona and Real Madrid. And again, why would soccer fans watch the MLS match? So I guess they're in a tough position. We know that. But sometimes their scheduling decisions have to be smarter.
Absolutely. All right, listener mailbag. The first one up is the T Mangrove. And the T Mangrove says, thank you for the retrospective on Peter Brackley. He was definitely one of my favorites. The Channel 4 coverage of Serie A was repackaged for broadcast here in the US in the mid-90s. I believe it was on Prime Network before Fox took over. They had extended highlights from their live match, which typically featured Brackley, in addition to the highlights of the other games. This was my first experience and exposure to the league, and he was a huge reason the show was so good. I may have to dig out some of my old VHS tapes this weekend. Yeah, Kartik, I forgot about Prime Network. Now that he mentions it, I remember that watching some games late in the hours, sometimes at midnight. It was soccer was so unpopular during the 80s and early 90s that oftentimes I'd have to get my VHS tape out and tape something at 2 o'clock in the morning or midnight or 3 o'clock in the morning, and that was the only time that soccer was on.
Yeah, it was really nice to get this email from T Mangrove, because I had forgotten about that. And I remember actually sticking the old VHS tapes in the VCR and then setting my VCR to record at midnight or 1 a.m. so that I could get these clips to get these soccer highlights. So you would get a Serie A package that they would show on Prime Network, which was Fox Sports Regional. We got it on a channel called Sunshine Network here in Florida. Mm-hmm. And then there was a Premier League program, which Fox actually produced out of L.A., which everyone remembers the Lionel Bienvenue. I think a lot of people remember that I did the same thing for. But I remember the Serie A program distinctly now that we got this listener mail, this listener feedback, which I had completely forgotten about and neglected when we had the retrospective. So thank you so much for that. And I used to actually, I might have some of those VHS tapes somewhere, not that they're useful anymore, but with old Serie A clips with him calling them.
Yeah, I have a box full of the old English Premier League highlights show. I think they're probably about like 15 or 20 VHS tapes that are completely full with all this stuff from probably the late 80s, early 90s.
There was one I saved of that, I have to say, which was when Steven Gerrard made his Liverpool debut, which is a match against Spurs, in the festive period in 1998. I still have that VHS tape. I know where it is. There's no way I can watch it, but I know where it is because it's got Steven Gerrard's debut, full senior league debut. Played in a cup match or two, but senior league debut on VHS.
That's awesome. All right, next up is Tim Keane, and Tim says, watching Manchester United and Arsenal and Chelsea, on Sunday morning on NBCSN, and we were given it was Saturday morning. I'm sorry, what am I talking about? And we were given a real treat with the commentators Derek Ray and Phil Neville. Not sure what it is, but they had so much they had so much enjoyment of the game. But I wonder if you could ask. If you could answer this question for me. In the pre-game show, all they talk about is Jose Mourinho. If I was watching in the UK, would we be subjected to this almost constant noise about Mourinho, almost to the exclusion of any other aspect of the game? Or would we get a more balanced discussion as to what games were going on and what it meant? Kartik, what do you think on this one?
That's a really good question.
I can answer it. I would say no way. I mean, that basically that you would still get probably the same constant noise about Mourinho. You'd have, one of the pundits going on and on and on about Mourinho the whole time, and there'd be very little insight or analysis.
Okay, here's why I hesitated. I think you're right, but I think that it might be a more balanced discussion about Mourinho. There may be more Mourinho proponents on the set. Now, what happens on NBCSN, and also I should mention on ESPN FC, is that and I'm guilty of this too because I'm not a Mourinho fan. I think the conversations are always slanted towards some sort of shot at Mourinho or critique at Mourinho, and that feeds it, whether it's from Martino, Musto, or Earl. And then at ESPN FC, particularly from Shaka and Craig Burley, those two guys. And then everybody kind of feeds off that. I think it might be a more balanced discussion with a former Chelsea player on there that will defend Mourinho. Like that. But yeah, it's probably the same. It might even be worse there in terms of they'll just obsess and focus on it.
I would say that on Sunday, this would have been Saturday, probably Saturday, around about goal zone or right before goal zone, they had Rebecca Lowe just saying, okay, hey, if you missed the Chelsea-Man United game, what a game this was. And you won't believe what happened after the final whistle, or right at the end of the final whistle. And it was Rebecca Lowe playing up the incident with Mourinho and the Chelsea coach more than what happened in the game itself. So NBC is definitely guilty of this in terms of playing into that soap opera, which is entertaining. That's one of the things about the Premier League in many ways, is that soap opera off the game is sometimes more interesting, or it's going to generate a lot more discussion than the game itself, which is not what it's supposed to be about, which is why a lot of the other leagues from around the world, whether it's La Liga or Bundesliga, are actually technically better leagues. And there's not a lot of off-the-field drama, not as much as in the Premier League. But Tim, a good question then in regards to what the UK discussion would be. John Average Geek asks, he says, I notice in Italy and in Germany, the steel fencing between the pitch and the stadium and the stands. Why is this still a thing? It seems so 1980s. And it's still such a thing because there's still issues. I mean, in Italy, with Serie A, with the ultras, with the fans, I mean, they're still very, very intense there. Germany, not so much, but it's more about segregation, just trying to segregate the away fans from the home fans to make sure that they're not fighting against each other. Without the fencing, there would be issues. There would be big issues. And that's the thing, too. In the Premier League, too, even though there's no fencing, and there was plenty of fencing in the 70s and 80s, there's still incidents that happen. And oftentimes, you'll find out about it on social media as far as some fights, either inside the stadium or outside the stadium. But it's really, you don't hear much about it. I mean, obviously they're trying to downplay it. But yeah, Italy and Germany still has some issues.
Couple quick points here. Now, in terms of Italy, we like Serie A as a product that's exported to the world that we watch on television. The domestic game in Italy right now is in the same domestic game was in England in the 1980s. And in the same way, it's losing a lot of interest from domestic people who might even have been soccer fans who are saying there's too much violence, there's too much match fixing or potential match fixing, there's too many financial irregularities, there's too much hanky-panky in the game. And so crowds have dropped. The attendance for Serie A, I think, will stun people if they actually checked out it. Most of the stadiums are old, kind of municipally owned stadiums, like what we had in the U.S. coming out of the 1970s, those multi-purpose stadiums that were owned by cities or locales or townies. Similar thing there. So Serie A is exported a very good football product to the rest of the world, but within Italy domestically, it's very similar to where the English First Division was in the 1980s. As far as Germany's concerned, I think it's just because they have so many fans and such a robust fan culture. This will shock people who are Premier League-centric or Premier League only, but the atmospheres at games in Germany are actually better than the atmospheres at games in the Premier League. Their fans aren't violent, typically, but there is still the need to give some layer of security for the players. But in Italy, just circling back on that, the situation is not good domestically in the sport in that country. I know we take this from an American perspective often, and we're praising Serie A because of the quality of play and the quality of broadcast and what we're seeing on our television screens or on our streaming product on our tablet, et cetera, on our phones. But the domestic game is just like England in the 1980s. I think that's actually a great analogy from John Average.
Yeah, and actually with the Premier League too, you're more likely to see stewards segregating the away fans from the home fans, just like at the City of Manchester Stadium at the Etihad in the corner there, where you have the away fans. Instead of having fencing that like you would in a Bundesliga stadium, you just have lines and lines of police and stewards there. The stewards sometimes in other games, like for example, or other leagues like the Bundesliga, you're more likely to see stewards along the kind of pitch side, kind of encircling the pitch, but not actually in the stadium. At least that's what I've seen. Kartik, last comment from one of our listeners, and this is from Anthony Bellow, and he says, hi guys, I just saw this article in the Daily Mail, which is entitled, Amazon Prime Consider Introducing All Women Commentary Teams for Its Premier League Coverage, after the positive response to NFL coverage. And Anthony says, it's the first hint of Amazon's plans for next year. What do you think? And Kartik, to me, this is one of those things that I'm, at the end of the day, no matter what gender, no matter what accent, to me, it's like you just want to have whoever's best available to actually broadcast that. So it should be based on talent. It's interesting that Amazon is considering doing this. Whether or not they will do it, I'm not sure. But if the talent is good enough, I'm fine with it. That's my side.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I actually, again, I know I knock the NFL all the time on this show, but I was for another publication asked to cover Amazon. A rare NFL thing that I had to deal with was Amazon making this, doing this. And I didn't actually watch the game, whichever game it was, but it was really experienced, good broadcast journalists, Hannah Storm and Andrea Kramer, both of whom maybe have been limited in their upward mobility in terms of commentary because they were women. And I feel the same way about the Premier League. I think there is a kind of pigeonholed role for females. It's changed a little bit, but pigeonholed role for females in terms of how they're viewed as presenters or as people who can analyze football or commentate about football in the United Kingdom, a stereotype we've gotten over in the United States. So I would actually encourage Amazon to do that because I can tell you if it's the best available talent and we're being truly objective about it, the best available talent that isn't being used in similar roles on BT or Sky are probably females, quite honestly. So I would encourage this.
Yeah, going back to Turner Sports for a second, and in my kind of critical analysis of their talent that they have, whether it's Tim Howard or whether it's Carlos Bocanegra or Maurice Serdu or some of these other players that they've had in that setting, is it, in some ways it's very much a reflection of how the talent level, the kind of the analysis level among American, I guess, studio pundits across the board, for the most part, is pretty weak. I mean, you have exceptions. So, like, Carlo Martino, I think, does a fantastic job. Taylor Twellman, I haven't heard in a while, but when I've seen him give analysis, he's been good. There's Janusz Michalik, who's a U.S. international. He gives good analysis. And you can go down the list. There's definitely talent out there that are very good. But in terms of kind of the next, I guess, the next wave of talent in the United States, I mean, Hercules Gomez is one, again, another example of somebody that's really good at analysis. Seb Salazar, you go down the list. There are many Americans that have good talent, but then there's also a lot of Americans that are pretty mediocre. They just aren't as good as some other ones out there. And that's probably a reflection of Turner and some of the challenges they're having in actually providing some good analysis. There's not a lot of available choices.
Yeah, the problem is there's a circuit of former national team players that are of a certain age, certain kind of a pedigree on the national team. Hercules Gomez doesn't fit that. And maybe that's why he's a lot better and a lot more opinionated and just, I think, sharper and much more useful to listen to and interact with than a lot of these other guys. But there's a certain circuit of former national team players where that pool comes from, and they all have kind of very conformist opinions about things. Mm-hmm. They won't step out too far on anything U.S. or CONCACAF related. And then when it comes to watching the European game, they're not as analytical about it as perhaps a more seasoned analyst or someone with a different background would be. Now, you mentioned Giannis. He's a former U.S. men's national team player also, but he comes from a different generation. I think that generation was more analytical, even Lawless at times, but Balboa, John Harkes, Eric Winalda, when those guys were on television, right? Mm-hmm. They tended to be a little more detailed in how they could analyze things and analyze player movements. Now, this also may reflect on the decline of the U.S. men's national team, because I've mentioned a lot about how positioning sense of the likes of Lawless and Balboa and Eddie Pope, even though they played 20 years ago, was better than the center backs the U.S. has now. They read the game better. That reflects in the analysis they give on television. So I think it's a real problem. And back to the UK thing, I think that there's been a tendency to hire ex-jocks, male players that don't really know a whole lot, but it's because of who they know in the business or their reputations as players that get them on the likes of Sky and BT and ITV when they were covering football a lot more. They don't provide as much as perhaps some of the female voices could. So, again, my hope is Amazon does this, because I think they'll probably find some really good female voices out there that we haven't heard enough from. Yeah. Well, look, NBC took a chance on Rebecca Lowe. I think that's worked out pretty well. And who knows if she would have ever been given the same opportunity if she had stayed in Britain.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the one thing about the analysis from a lot of these former U.S. men's national team players is that they are conforming. They are making sure that they say the right things and not being too critical about certain things, because part of it is job protection. So, for example, Marisa Du got pulled into the USA friendly recently that was on FS1. So they're looking out for their careers. They're looking out to make sure that kind of they go up the ladder, being able to give opportunities to give analysis on U.S. men's national team games. Or maybe it's going to be on the next World Cup, or maybe other opportunities that come along.
And you know what the irony is? I know a lot of people who listen to the show don't agree with this, and maybe they're not paying close enough attention, and they have their views that everybody is an MLS hack. The writers who cover the national team and cover American soccer, even some of the ones you would characterize as being very pro MLS, with the exception of Grant Wall, I think he's still very careful, have become more and more a non-conformist in the last 6 months than any time previously. You know, I think about the amount of really just shots at MLS and the U.S. Soccer Federation I get now from reading Jeff Carlisle or Paul Tenorio or Charles Bohm. But that's not being reflected in the analysts that are on television. So now there's a disconnect. It used to be everyone was singing from the same song sheet. And I, as people know, I blame the media a great deal for the failure of the U.S. to qualify for the 2018 World Cup, thinking that they had created this bubble and this insular culture of conformity and comfort, really, for the men's national team players and for the coaches. But I think the written press has moved on from that and now is at times maybe too critical. But that has not been reflected on the in the punditry on television, with the exception of particularly Hercules Gomez and Seb Salazar. With those two very notable exceptions, I think, you know, there were spots Taylor Twellman is critical. I think there's spots that some others may be critical. But generally, it's still the same thing on television as opposed to what we're seeing in written the written press now. And I don't know when that's going to change, Chris. And that's something, as we continue to analyze television and streaming, we're going to have to hold those guys accountable, because they're not moving along with the fan base and with the written press. They're just still in some other reality, which isn't being reflected on what we're seeing in the matches.
Yeah, and that's one more thing to add to that, too, is just that when you look at ESPN's coverage of the U.S. men's national team and how critical it is, I mean, both negative and positive, but more critical, more hard-hitting versus Fox, there's very still rah-rah USA, and it doesn't... I mean, Fox has the World Cup, so they almost have to be very, very pro-US, whether it's for the men's team or the women's team. Luckily, the women's team is doing quite well right now, but, you mean, they have to be pro in order to try to attract those viewers in. Not that they have to, it's just that that's their MO, is to be very pro-USA, to bring in those sports fans that are not necessarily into soccer, but will support the United States. And what they don't want to happen is have viewers coming into games and have the analysis be negative to the U.S., because the viewer may think of that as being anti-USA, which is not. It's just, I mean, we just want soccer and the U.S. men's national team and the women's team to raise the bar, to be better, to grow. And with that becomes, you mean, with that comes sometimes some things that people don't want to hear, some analysis or critiques or recommendations or just some feedback sometimes that's hard to swallow. But at the end of the day, it's going to make things better, because then it's more of the reality rather than this fake land that we live in. And with Fox's coverage of the U.S. men's national team for many years, it hasn't aligned with the reality. And like you said, Kartik, too, I think it's going to take a while before things change. And also in some ways, too, with the U.S. women's national team next year, that'll be kind of a lift, hopefully, with the U.S. in France in the Women's World Cup. But that doesn't help the men's team, unfortunately. And even with the Gold Cup too, I just don't have a lot of meaning in that tournament. It's relatively, until the semifinal stage and the final stage, it's a pretty meaningless tournament.
Yeah, it's going on at the same time as the Women's World Cup too, which creates a programming challenge for Fox. But although I guess it could show one during the day and one at night. The last thing I'll say on this is if and when the U.S. do lose in the Women's World Cup, I know they look very good. I think Lindsey Horan and Emily Saunette being in that midfield have really kind of transformed the way they play. So they have a chance to defend their world championship, which I did not think was the case a year ago. I thought the U.S. was going to be humbled in this World Cup in France. But if and when they still do lose at some stage to a France, to an Australia, to an England, there are still some teams that can really compete with them. Japan is going through a youth movement. They could maybe rise back up. We've seen them beat the U.S. in a final before. I wonder how Fox is going to handle it, because I think their eggs are all in the basket of, well, the U.S. is a dominant women's power, and they're going to win this thing. I mean, I even the culture at Fox, I mean, I think Allie Wagner is really good when she does games on Lifetime, and she's decent on Fox too. But there is a different kind of level of critique that goes on. And then you watch ESPN when they've got Ian Dark and Julie Foudy, or Seven and Julie Foudy doing matches, and Julie Foudy's analysis is different and more critical than Now, of course, she's become a critic of the Federation the last few years. I think everybody knows that. But it's just, again, culturally, even in the women's game, ESPN is handling things better, differently than Fox. So we'll see.
All right, listeners, if you have any feedback for us, if you agree or disagree with anything we've just said, or you want to get some advice on streaming or watching games on television, you name it, let us know. We'd love to read out those comments on air. You can always reach us through email via web at worldsoccertalk.com, as well as facebook.com/worldsoccertalk, and on Twitter at worldsoccertalk. Plus, of course, you can always post comments on worldsoccertalk.com. So thank you for listening. You can get a new episode of the World Soccer Talk podcast every Thursday. Every episode is released on SoundCloud, YouTube, Stitcher, iTunes, TuneIn, Audioboom, and worldsoccertalk.com. If you like the show, please leave a review for us on iTunes. We'd greatly appreciate it. And we've gotten quite a few this past few weeks from you guys, so we really appreciate that. And Kartik, looking ahead to this weekend, you've got Spurs against Man City. You've got Man United against Everton. You've got El Clasico on Sunday happening. You've also got some big matches in Liga, the final day of the MLS regular season, plus much, much more from around the world. What should they do this weekend?
Enjoy your football.